Support for this podcast comes from San Francisco International Airport. At SFO, you can discover award-winning flavors and unique shops all before takeoff. Learn more about what's at SFO at flysfo.com.
Hey, it's Avery Trufelman, host of Articles of Interest. And I've got to say, I've been a fan of KQED ever since I was a little kid, and I would come out to San Francisco to visit my grandma. It was just what we'd always turn on every time we got in the car, every time we were making dinner and turning on the radio. It was always KQED. And then over the years, I've become a massive fan of KQED podcasts because this is local reporting at its best. These are answers to questions you've always wanted to know, interviews with exciting, unusual voices, necessary journalism, all told with love and care and artistry. And did you know that a majority of KQED's funding actually comes from members? It's just people like you and me supporting the programs they love, while also getting access to cool events, behind-the-scenes footage, and so much more. If you want to sign up and be a part of this amazing community, visit donate.kqed.org/podcasts to become a member today. That's podcasts with an S. Thank you for listening, and thank you for your support.
From KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Michael Krasny. In his latest book, The Splendid and the Vile, author Eric Larson probes the extraordinary leadership of Winston Churchill during World War II as he tried to hold England together during a German bombing campaign that killed more than 40,000 people. The book spans 12 months, beginning in May 1940 with Churchill's first day as Prime Minister, just as Germany invaded Holland and Belgium. The best-selling author of In the Garden of Beasts and The Devil in the White City, Larson joins us to talk about Churchill's leadership and what lessons it holds for our current political climate. That's next, after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. In his most recent book, The Splendid and the Vile, author Eric Larson profiles Winston Churchill during his first year as Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. Larson, a best-selling nonfiction writer whose books include Devil in the White City, joins us now to talk about Churchill's leadership, from taking office on the day Germany invaded Holland and Belgium to the way he's remembered today. And welcome back to Forum, Eric Larson.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
Glad to have you with us. And let me just say, for the sake of listeners understanding what you've set out and accomplished here, this is not only a portrait of Prime Minister Churchill during that first year, May 1940 to May 1941, but also of the Churchill family and also of his first year as Prime Minister and the Blitz, the air campaign, which takes us right to really what inspired you to write this book. It was an epiphany. You moved from Seattle to New York, and talk about what you reflected on in terms of, well, I think what you described as 57 9/11s.
Yeah. What happened is, I mean, this is one of those rare books where I can absolutely place the moment when the conception arose. We had been living in Seattle for years, and our three daughters had all grown up, as daughters do, and they had moved off. And we decided, you know, maybe it was time to move to a new locale. And I've always wanted to live in Manhattan, so we gave that a shot. We're still here. But as soon as we arrived in Manhattan, I had this what I have described as a kind of an epiphany having to do with 9/11. You know, it's when we were in Seattle, we experienced that the way, you know, most Americans did, you know, remotely, but, you know, in real time, watching CNN or some other source as the towers fell. It was horrific as it was. But when I arrived in New York, it became so clear to me, vividly clear, how much more traumatic 9/11 was to New Yorkers than it was to the rest of us. You know, maybe that's sort of a duh moment for people, but for me, it became just very, very clear. And I started to wonder, you know, how on earth did New Yorkers deal with it? And then I started to think, wait a minute, what about London, which, if in effect, during the peak of the Blitz, had 57 consecutive 9/11s? How did people actually cope with that? So I started thinking about maybe doing a book that would try to get an answer to that question. I thought about trying to find a typical London family, maybe at the Imperial War Museum in London, see if any diaries there might provide that sort of thing. And I thought, wait a minute, why not do the quintessential London family, Churchill and his family, to see how they got through it? I mean, here's Churchill. He becomes prime minister on the day the war becomes a real war. You know, previously it was known as the phony war, and there was a lot of death, but it was not the super hot war that began on the day he became prime minister. How did they all endure this for that first year, which essentially coincided with the German air campaign, the most important German air campaign of the war? So that's how it came to be.
Well, you gave us, provided us a very intimate portrait of the family, and I want to talk with you about that, but you also provided us a rich historical experience with all the sensory details and stories, not only the Churchill family stories, but other stories that you gleaned from diaries and memoirs. It's a very novelistic book, big on weather, I might add. And you didn't have, I don't believe you had any kind of preconception about Churchill himself. You hadn't watched The Crown or The Darkest Hour, or you hadn't seen Lithgow or Oldham's interpretations of Churchill.
Yeah, no. In fact, really, I came to Churchill. I think as most of the readers who have enjoyed this book have came to him, which is not an expert at all. I mean, I knew certain things about him, but one thing I really wanted to avoid was coming in with any sort of preconception of what Churchill was like as a physical presence or as a an audio presence. And so I really avoided watching any of the video representations of him, like The Crown or Darkest Hour. And in fact, I only saw Darkest Hour when the book was just about done. And I was flying back from London on a British air flight. Gosh, remember that era? Anyway, I was flying back on a British air flight. And I was sort of looking through what the video offerings were on the flight, and there was Darkest Hour. So I thought, hey, you know, I'm out of the woods. I'll watch. So that was the first time I actually saw that particular representation of him.
Yeah, we had Kristen Scott Thomas on the Forum program who played Clementine. It was a small role, but certainly a much bigger role, as I think you make us aware of in his life and at this time, than we saw in that movie. Interested in talking with you, though, Eric, about Churchill's leadership, particularly in light of the fact that we had leadership that was quite divided for quite the last 4 years, I think it's fair to say, whatever your partisan politics may be in terms of the country, still very polarized and divided, and divided even now during the pandemic when we need to rise to a certain level of unity. Somehow Churchill managed to bring these people into unity. And this book of yours is also a story about the resilience and the character of the people themselves. But talk about his leadership and talk about really what it's all about.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I never really intended this to become a book about leadership. And you know, in fact, it's not. I mean, what it is supposed to be an immersive experience in how people actually got through the day But it really, in the course of my work, I began to become I became a big admirer of leadership, of Churchill's leadership skills. Whether he was born with them or learned them, I don't know. I can't say. But he did some things that were, when you look at how he negotiated that first year of his prime ministry, one of the things that stands out always about Churchill is how he delivered news to the public, how he spoke to the public. You know, and we're all familiar with his great lines, you know, never before have so many owed so much to so few, that kind of thing. But I began to appreciate the subtler aspects of his speeches and how important those were as part of his palette, if you will, of leadership skills. You know, he would begin his speeches. He'd begin his speeches with a sober assessment of the reality of the situation. No happy talk, nothing like, you know, it's going to go away. A sober appraisal of what the situation was, because he understood something very important that true leaders understand, and that is that the public knows. Even though they may not know specific details of events and so forth, the public knows broadly what the situation is. You lie to him, to them, you will set up a dissonant situation that will affect ultimately morale. So he would start his speeches with a very sober assessment of the situation, you know, not sugarcoating. Then he would follow up with real cause for optimism. you know, what was there perhaps in the pipeline in terms of military force and so forth? What else was going on that promised to help Britain out of the situation? And then toward the end of the speech, or at the end, would come one of those glowing moments where he would just get everybody to metaphorically sort of rise from their seats and you know, charge out into the streets to do battle with the Germans. It was a very, very important aspect of how he managed to get people, first of all, to trust him, and also to band together. You know, somebody once said to him, "Well, you gave people courage," and he said, "No, I didn't give them courage. I helped them find their own," and that was very important.
That was the soaring rhetoric that really instilled and inspired people to. I guess the best way to say it is act. I mean, and feel that they were at one in acting. He had a terrific grasp of history, too, as you point out in your book, and he put citizens' roles into that history in a remarkable way. We can certainly talk about, you know, the things that can take away from Hitler, from his, shall we say, reputation and his leadership. He was kind of a colonialist at heart, and we could go into all those flaws and so forth, but standing out as a leadership and also standing out as a resilience of the people and how they got through, and there are lessons there, too.
Oh yeah, absolutely. But I want to go back to something you touched on about his one other aspect of his oratorical skills was that he had a way. He was indeed very well read in terms of the history of the world, of the British Empire in particular, and he had a way of fitting his readers into the and his listeners into the grand story of British history, making them feel like they shared this grand story, and they shared very importantly in how that story was ultimately going to work out. So that was a very important aspect. Yeah, in terms of resilience, I mean, one of the things that I was really impressed by going through my research was that you know, this drive to just try to live your life as best you could in the corners that were allowed, you know, when bombing wasn't occurring. And there was a whole phase after the initial phase, after the Germans realized it was too costly to bomb during the day, when bombings occurred at night, suddenly there was a weird kind of normalcy that settled over the British Isles. And that is that, you know, from the hours of during the daylight hours, you could pretty much lead a normal life. It was after dark that when the bombing started that you had to make your choice. Do you go to a shelter? Do you go to the tube? Do you stay in your bed and pull the covers over your head? Which, you know, some people just chose that as their option. And so there was this sort of weird kind of normalcy that settled in. And part of that had to do, honestly, with Churchill as well. Because, you know, it cuts to this idea of him helping people find their courage. Churchill was essentially fearless. Whenever there was an air raid, he was much more likely to climb to the roof of the nearest building to watch than to duck into a shelter. And you know, this fearlessness is infectious. You know, I talk about him teaching the public the art of being fearless. And I think that it really is the case that if you see your leader, constantly, not constantly, but, you know, always reflecting, always demonstrating a real profound sense of courage and optimism, you're gonna feel the same way. And that was, I think, a very important thing that he did. There's a scene that I just love. I mean, there was a dinner party that Churchill was having in his armored apartment called the Annex, 10 Downing Annex. He was having this dinner party for himself, his wife Clementine, one of the U.S. ambassadors. This was the U.S. ambassador, Tony, I can't remember his last name, who was assigned to London to look after the exiled kings and so forth that had been driven from Europe by Hitler, other staff and so forth. So an air raid begins as they're having dinner. And of course, as one does, Churchill decides he's going to lead the entire party up to the rooftop to watch this raid unfold. So they go up to this series of, you know, steps and ladders and so forth up to the roof to watch this thing. And while they're on the roof, Churchill is so smart, so well read. Churchill quotes Tennyson. quotes a poem called Locksley Hall, which when you read it seems to foretell.
Sorry, Eric, hold that thought. We've got to cut away for about a minute. We'll be right back. We'll hear about Locksley Hall and the poem. Stay tuned. More with Eric Larson when we return. His new book is out. It's A Splendid in the Vial.
Support for Forum comes from San Francisco Opera. Set 10 years after a school shooting, the critically acclaimed opera Innocence takes us into a complex emotional journey where our understanding of innocence and guilt is constantly upended. Kaija Saariaho's ethereal score collapses the past into the present as a community of survivors grapple with how to move forward. Don't miss the highly anticipated American premiere of Innocence, June 1st through 21st. Learn more at sfopera.com.
This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our guest is Eric Larson, and his new book is called The Splendid and the Vial, a saga of Churchill, family, and defiance during the Blitz. And we should mention that he will be one of the authors in the 32nd National Kidney Foundation Literary Luncheon, which I've been participating in for many years. This year, in the dinner the night before, Kelly Corrigan, my former student, will be the host of the luncheon, and Britt Bennett and Gail Tsukiyama and a number of other authors will be there, John Grisham as well. And before we had to go to that break, Eric, sorry to say, the book came out in February, by the way, so I want to make that clear that the book has been out for a while. In fact, just a quick note from a listener named Christine who emails us. Thank you, Eric Larson, for helping me stay sane in 2020. The Splendid and the Vial was my bedtime reading during those crazy first days of shelter in place. At a time when leadership has never been sorely lacking in America, it was immensely heartening to be reminded of the timeless leadership qualities of bravery, honesty, and true love of fellow man. So we go back to your story. Sorry to break into your narrative there, but you had us on the roof.
Yeah, let me just finish that. Yeah. So there's Churchill and his the people who are attending his dinner party. He leads them up onto the roof during an air raid, so they can watch. And while he's up there, he quotes Tennyson. He quotes a poem called Locksley Hall, which when you read it does seem to foretell the advent of aerial warfare, you know, long before there were even aircraft. And I just found that such a remarkable moment. I mean, not only does the guy have the composure to remember Tennyson, you know, as bombers are flying over and parts of London are being obliterated, but he chooses that poem, you know, which seems to foretell what they're watching. So anyway, that was one of my favorite little moments.
Yeah, and you speak about it with that kind of favor that's noticeable to me. Also, we should mention that the title comes from one of his private secretaries, John Colville's diary, Bombing and Battles of the RAF and the Luftwaffe, and an air raid that was also being watched by Coulson and others. Again, Eric Larson is our guest. And by the way, if you would like to weigh in here, or if you have questions for Eric Larson, you want to talk about Churchill and leadership and getting certainly the other side of Churchill from listeners, let me just read, well, some of them are coming in. Let me ask you to weigh in here as listeners with any questions or comments you might have. And by the way, you can do that by talking to us on the phone at 866-733-6786. You can join us toll free, and that's the number to call, 866-733-6786, or get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email us, forum@kqed.org. The email I was going to read, just the other side of Churchill, of course, that many have pointed out through the years, is from Paul, who writes, Winston Churchill participated in genocide in Pakistan and Sudan. He was a fan of the concentration camps set up by the Boers in South Africa. He pushed colonialism across the globe, was no friend of the Irish or the Kurds, and proclaimed the Aryan stock is bound to triumph. Let 3 million starve in Bengal. His legacy of brutality and racism should not be forgotten. And I think Paul...
Warren, what's your name? Where are you calling from?
I'm sorry. Paul is right in many of those points, Eric Larson.
Oh, yeah. I mean, look, Churchill was, for all intents and purposes, essentially a 19th century imperialist with all the baggage that entails. But he was, in fact, without... I don't think anybody can dispute this. He was the man for the hour in this period, in what is arguably Britain's darkest hour, at least before this pandemic. So you know, attack him at will. I'm not gonna disagree with you, but he was the man for the hour.
It's also a man who is presented by you in a very multidimensional portrait, and I'm not only talking about good and evil here, which he certainly embodied, you know. He was larger than life in so many ways, but also the way you portray him, there was a frivolous side that's unescapable, a fun side. You were talking about the dinner party that led up to the roof to the story you told. There was also dinner at Checkers in the Great Hall, and here comes Winston Churchill in a one-piece jumpsuit with his own design, we ought to add, and doing bayonet drills and singing all kinds of things from Gilbert and Sullivan and The Wizard of Oz and Run, yeah, Rabbit, Run.
So that's I think the biggest, the most surprising thing to me was how much fun Churchill was. I mean, he could be rude, he could be deeply inconsiderate. There's no question about that. But the reality is that his staff, his private secretaries, they all loved him because he could be an awful lot of fun, and he was intellectually so stimulating. And also, honestly, he was a very warm, compassionate guy when the opportunity arose. You know, he was not afraid to weep in public, and that was something else that endeared the British public to him.
Something else I wanted to touch on with you when we're talking about the man and his character and his personality and certainly leadership is just the way he was able to woo, and I think that's the right verb, FDR. It was vital for the United States to get involved in the war to help Britain, and he wooed him really never so no lover so ardent. It was a vital necessity. He said, I shall drag America in, and he did.
Well, literally, from his first day or two as prime minister, he recognized the reality that Britain, in his view, Britain could perhaps have fought to a stalemate with Germany, but could not have prevailed, would not prevail without the full participation of the United States. And he set about on this courtship that really very much, you know, metaphorically is, you know, sort of like a young man, you know, courting the love of his life. And he acknowledged that courtship aspect later on in one of his writings. But, you know, he did recognize this, and he set about in a very methodical way to try to lure America, to lure FDR specifically into his net, if you will. And he succeeded. I mean, he succeeded to a large extent. Of course, in the end, it was the Japanese invasion of Pearl Harbor that brought America, you know, full-heartedly into the war. But you know, everything short of that was thanks to Churchill's courtship.
Yeah, but you give us Harry Hopkins, you know, uttering those words from the Book of Ruth about, you know, essentially, your people are my people, and we will go with you. It's actually very moving to think about. Let me go to a caller. Let's bring Will in as our first caller. Will, join us. You're on.
Yeah, Mr. Larson, were you surprised that Winston Churchill lost the English general election in 1945?
Well, you know, I vaguely knew about it, but as I read into details of it, I was really shocked, you know, especially after spending a year, not spending a year, I spent 4 years on this book, but after dwelling in that 1 year of Churchill's prime ministry, you know, that first year, and just appreciating his leadership skills and what he went through to bring to you know, essentially save the British Empire, if you will. And then, you know, at the last minute, you know, when all the awards and honors should have been, you know, accruing to him, he gets thrown out of office. But, you know, I shocked, yes, but I also understood it. It was a change that the British seemed to need, that from this warrior in charge, you know, he could be erratic. He was always very energetic, but he was this warrior in charge of the war, in charge of the empire. And maybe now with the end in sight, I think the feeling was that, you know, something else was needed, maybe more stability, a steadier hand.
Again, we're talking with Eric Larson, and his recent book is The Splendid and the Vile, a saga of Churchill, family, and defiance during the Blitz. Here's Kevin. Kevin, join us. Welcome.
Good morning. For all of Churchill's grand historical image, He had the exact wrong strategy for the European theater. He wanted to avoid invading France, and he wanted to concentrate on the Mediterranean and saving his empire.
Oh, yeah, I agree with you. Well, I don't know about if he wanted to concentrate on saving his empire per se, but I would agree with you that in terms of tactics and strategy, and I actually say that in the book, that he was essentially a terrible strategist, terrible tactician. But what he was very good at was arousing the public to stay the course, to carry on as he said, and to bring forth their courage. That was his biggest accomplishment.
I wonder what you thought of, there was a review of your book by Gerard de Groot of St. Andrews, historian in the Washington Post. He called you a superb storyteller, which I think is indubitably true beyond any reason. But then he kind of took you on something. I'd like to get your response to it. You said that you seem to give the indication that Churchill was, along with the upper class, leading the working class, when the working class, leading them into bravery and courage, when the working class were brave and courageous to begin with. I think that was the gist of his criticism. The real war, in fact, he seemed to say, came out of the factories and came out of the workers who were the brave ones, not necessarily because they were instilled by Churchill, but because of their basic backbone. I think I'm giving a fair rendering of what he said.
No, you are. I remember reading that. I remember reading that review. To each his own. That's his opinion. I spent 4 years immersed in that period, and I have to disagree with him. I mean, yes, of course, there was a fundamental seam of courage there is in everybody, right? But I have to feel that I do feel and feel after my research that he really did bring something forth. Maybe it was there to begin with. I don't know, but he really did bring something forth through his demonstrated skills at leadership.
Well, he certainly, you give us a German perspective, which I think is a very important part of your book. And people like Goebbels couldn't believe, his, from their perspective, intransigence, that he wouldn't come to the peace table.
Right. They thought he was nuts. Hitler thought he was nuts.
But that's the kind of leadership, too. I mean, people thought that Trump was nuts, and then other people said, well, he acted nuts in some ways that maybe were to his advantage.
Okay, well, but if we're going to start talking about nuts, let's. I don't even want to go there at the moment, but in talking about the appraisal of how the Germans appraised Churchill, when I say they thought him nuts, in other words, their expectation was that Churchill would confronted by the obvious might of Germany, that Churchill would obviously would cave, that there's no question that he would want to come to the peace table, which is actually what Hitler really did want in this early period of the war. Hitler did not want to have an active enemy behind him when he pursued his ambitions in the East, in the Soviet Union, and so forth. And so Hitler and Goebbels and Goering, they were really surprised at Churchill's backbone, if you will. I think that was a very important part of his leadership also.
We also should mention here, I think, Eric, that the RAF had air superiority. Goering promised to destroy them, of course, but there was great naval support that Britain had that Germany didn't have.
Well, are you talking about naval support or
Naval support, yeah.
Yeah. Well, yes. I mean, if you want to get into the how things were arrayed during this year in terms of the potential for invasion by Germany and so forth, Churchill's appraisal, I think he was quite wise in this. His appraisal was that there was certainly a very major threat that Germany would actually invade the British Isles soon after essentially taking over Western Europe. There was a major concern about that, but he understood that Britain had this powerful navy and that Germany was actually weak on the naval front. For Germany to pull off an invasion of the British Isles, it would have to involve an amphibious assault. And that was something that he doubted that Germany actually had the ability to do, unless the Germans somehow managed to attain air superiority. And this is where Churchill, I said that he's a terrible tactician and strategist, but in one area he was and I don't want to emphasize the terrible part too much, but in one area, he was actually very, very astute. He immediately recognized that the most important thing was for the RAF to maintain air superiority over the British Isles. The only way to do that, he understood, was to increase the production of fighter aircraft. And day one, he established a whole new ministry, the Ministry of Aircraft Production, and put his friend Max Beaverbrook, Max Aiken, Lord Beaverbrook, in charge of that new ministry, a very controversial appointment in the view of many, because Beaverbrook was very outspoken, very caustic, very abrasive, but he turned out to be the man for that job as well. So Churchill recognized early on that it was absolutely crucial to produce as many fighters as possible, because it was the fighters who were capable of knocking down the German bombers, and it was the German bombers that, you know, otherwise would have been, you know, bombing the aircraft industries, bombing the airfields and so forth without any kind of resistance from the British. And if that had happened, if Germany had achieved air superiority over Britain, invasion would have been much more likely, whether or not Britain had a powerful navy.
Yeah, you mentioned Lord Beaverbrook. I was struck by how many advisors Churchill had, sort of similar to what Doris Kearns Goodwin said about Lincoln, advisors who were not yes men or women, all men at that point, certainly. He kind of liked the conflict. And Beaverbrook, who had been a newspaper guy and went into aircraft production, actually resigned 14 times. And a lot of these advisors challenged Churchill. And that's an important part of leadership, too, I think. As I said, I thought of Doris Kearns Goodwin. Let me bring another caller in, though. Chuck wants to join us from Walnut Creek. Chuck, you're on. Good morning.
Thank you, Michael. Mr. Larson, much has been written about Churchill's prodigious alcohol consumption. I was wondering if your research confirmed, denied that, and does it play a role in your book? Not a role, but is it significant in your book?
Yeah, that's a very, very interesting question. I was fascinated by this in the course of my research. I think at some remove, there is a stereotypical perception of Churchill as being a drunk, you know, just constantly drinking and so forth. The story is actually a lot more complex than that. His staff, John Colville, his private secretary, who is a character, I say character, but, you know, real life historical person running through the story. John Colville wrote in his diary that he had never seen Churchill impaired by alcohol. And it is absolutely true that alcohol, his days were infused, if you will, with alcohol. He would begin the day often with a whiskey and water, tiny amount of whiskey in a lot of water. And then would come lunch, which was, of course, you know, champagne and wine and so forth. And then there was dinner with more wine, more booze, more. And then afterwards, there was more booze and so forth. But Churchill seemed to, definitely, at least in my, as far as what I saw, he really had it absolutely under control. And I think in some way he was maybe consciously or unconsciously just sort of slightly sedating himself during the day, almost as if, you know, the way somebody today might take a little bit of Xanax, you know, to get through the chaos of the pandemic or something.
Well, had depression. I mean, he called it the black dog. He was constantly trying to do something about that depression, wasn't he?
Bouts of depression. It tended to pass quite quickly, but he did have bouts of depression. But back to alcohol, he told Clementine something once that I think is very important to know about his alcohol consumption. He told her, he said, she was briefly, I guess, on his case about drinking too much. And he said to her, Clemmy, I've taken a lot more out of alcohol than alcohol has taken out of.
Well, the real drinker may have been his son, Randolph, who we can talk about perhaps time permitting, who was not only a drinker, but a gambler and a kind of ne'er-do-well. And I ought to mention that there's a portrait, portrait of the charming youngest daughter of Churchill in this book, too. It's all about the Churchill family, and it's about Churchill's leadership, and we'll take more of your calls when we return. We're talking to Eric Larson. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny.
We've all got those parts of our house where the internet just won't go. Well, if you had wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you could worry less about dead spots. Because with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you get fast speeds, reliable connection in every room, and power for all of your devices, even when everyone's online. That's wall-to-wall Wi-Fi, only with Xfinity. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our guest is Eric Larson. His recent book is called The Splendid and the Vile, A Saga of Churchill, Family, and Defiance During the Blitz. If you'd like to join us on the program and have some thoughts, perhaps, about Winston Churchill's legacy, give us a call now at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also get in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email any questions you may have to forum@kqed.org. Here's a question from Suzanne in a tweet. Eric wants to know, can Mr. Larson comment on Churchill's relationship with Stalin? I'm reading John Kelly's new book on Stalin, and this relationship is quite intriguing to me.
Yeah, you know, I am no expert on Churchill's relationship with Stalin. Stalin really came into the picture sort of really toward the end of the period that I was particularly interested in. But it's a fascinating relationship, very different than the relationship with Roosevelt. I think he saw Stalin as a potentially a dangerous foe in Britain's future, as opposed to like a lifelong ally. But he also recognized that the value of enlisting the aid of the Soviet Union as well. I think he said something to the effect that, you know, I'm going to botch that quote, so I'm not even going to try it. But yeah, no, he recognized it was very important to have Stalin as an ally, even though he really sort of had to hold his nose while doing it.
And here's Marty. Marty's our next caller. Marty, welcome.
Good morning. Had there been no Pearl Harbor, what would have brought America into the war? And was Churchill concerned about Lindbergh and his influence?
Boy, okay, two questions. Was Churchill concerned about Lindbergh? No. I got no sense of that. He was much more concerned about the Duke of, the guy who married Wallace Simpson. He was much more concerned about his influence, frankly. But tell me again the first question.
Had there been no Pearl Harbor, what would have brought America into the war?
Yeah. So, oh boy, that's speculative history, and I routinely vow never to engage in speculative history. However, it's a fascinating question. So here's my thought. Just firing from the hip. Churchill, FDR at heart favored intervention, and the big question was, when was that intervention going to happen? The Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor forced the issue. What else would have brought America in wholeheartedly? Hard to say. Maybe some other incident involving Japan. It's very difficult to engage in speculative history, but it's clear that the forces of the world were sort of driving America toward war regardless.
And let me thank Marty for his call and go right to another caller. And that's Robert. Robert, join us. You're on the air.
Hi. I have two questions for your guest. And it's with regards to that now famous speech that Churchill gave, we shall go on in the end. We shall fight in France. We shall fight in the ground. I wanted to know, what was the reaction of the people, of the citizens of Britain at the time? And then what was the reaction of the generals, the army personnel at the time as well? Because it seems as though, like, they were very, when he says, we will never surrender, that they were very fearful, but the people were very motivated. And that's just my impression.
Yeah, Eric Larson.
Yeah. Well, first of all, reaction to the speech. Interestingly, the Churchill's government was the Ministry of Information was really, really interested in public opinion and went to great lengths to try to tap many, many different sources, even gossip reported by booksellers, to try to get a sense of how the public was feeling about the war, how morale was, how people reacted to Churchill's speeches. And, you know, not surprisingly, there were those who were deeply concerned to hear Churchill talking about we shall fight and we shall never surrender. But overall, that particular speech, you know, the attitude that Churchill expressed, this bold, you know, we're not gonna give up, was very energizing for the public. It was really exactly the thing that people needed to hear at that time. The general staff was also totally in his camp. They happened not to have the forces to do it, having just been driven from France. But there was a very, very much a sort of a warrior confidence on the part of the military establishment. That's what I came across.
Well, speaking about that famous speech and the attitude that Churchill had, could you tell that story about his daughter-in-law and the carving knife?
His daughter-in-law and the carving knife. Refresh me.
Well, they were talking about what they would do if the Nazis came.
Okay, I know what you're talking about. Yes, yeah. No, so Churchill was telling his daughter-in-law Pamela, who was married to Randolph, the one we believe was alcoholic. Or at least dependent on alcohol. Anyway, he was talking about the importance of being able to, you know, to take out the Germans if they invaded, and she was expressing concern about, you know, what, you know, how could you, you know, how could she do that? And he just said, get a knife, you know, get a kitchen knife and take them out.
Carving knife, yeah. Well, there, you know, some of these stories that are punctuated in your book are really quite compelling and poignant. Drawn from not only the Churchill family, obviously, that's at the center of your book, but other things that come into play through the diaries and the wonderful research that you've done. There's a young woman who, for example, decided that she didn't want to die a virgin.
Oh, yes. Yeah. I love that. She was, this cuts to why I wrote this book in the first place. Really the point was, and this is what made it, I think, actually quite fresh in terms of Churchill's scholarship, was just how did people get by on a daily basis? And so this one woman was experiencing this tremendous air raid, and she was infatuated with this guy Rupert, and the raid was so intense that she resolved that next day that she was going to cease being a virgin, and that Rupert was the guy who was going to do it for her, and she proceeded then to do it. But it's kind of a funny, I don't necessarily want to quote the scene. I don't know what the moral standards are, KQED, but I think it was hilarious.
Well, the gist of it was it turned out to be not quite what she had been led to believe it would be in terms of, shall we say, delight or pleasure or anything along those lines. I was struck by that story. I was also struck excuse me, Eric, what were you saying? Sorry.
She said in the end that she'd frankly rather have a cigarette.
Yeah, right, or watch a movie, I think. But there was also a story in there which resonates today. You hear stories of young black men and boys being asked, "What do you?" Particularly during some of the terrible tragedies that occurred, murders by police, like in the case of George Floyd and so forth. They say, what do you want to be when you grow up?" And they say, "Alive." And that actually occurred in your book with the young boy who was asked that same question during the Blitz.
Exactly. That's what he was asked. You know, what do you want to be when you grow up? He said, alive.
Yeah. Let me bring another caller in. Nancy joins us next. Nancy, welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Larson, this is one of the best books I have read in a long, long time. I love The Devil in the White City also, but this one was so wonderful, and I really appreciated all the weaving in of real people's diaries and real experiences, and a lot of people, I read this with the book club, and some of the people didn't really understand where the information came from, and you did a fabulous job on that. I loved the... I thought the title of the book, I was thinking The Splendid was Churchill and the Vile was Hitler, and then I read the quote from Colville that said about the bombing and how beautiful it was splendid and vile. And So I really, really, really thank you for this book. I think it's an amazing achievement.
Thank you.
Thank you for the call. We'll go to another caller joining us, Liam. Liam, good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, I'd like to hear the author's thoughts on Churchill's decision to sink the French fleet in Morocco, I think, Mers el-Kabir. I understand that the French tried to surrender, and yet they were bottled up in the harbor, and the British Navy basically sunk the fleet there.
Yeah, that was one of the most, to me, one of the most moving and surprising moments. I had actually known nothing about that before I got into the research, and it was very, first of all, addressing that the French had tried to surrender. That is absolutely not the case. There is a very detailed collection of documents, the tick-tock, if you will, about how that whole situation unfolded. And it is clear that the French were definitely not planning trying to surrender the fleet. They were actually trying to sneak out of that particular base and escape this force H that had been sent by Churchill and the Admiralty to win them over. The whole point actually was initially that this naval force sent there in the Mediterranean was to offer the French an opportunity to join with the British Navy against the Germans, and they absolutely, without caveat, rejected that overture, and so ultimately Churchill came through on his ultimatum and destroyed. Well, blew up one and sank one battleship at a cost of 1,100 men, significant other damage to the French fleet. And it was, for Churchill, a very, very wrenching thing. He was an old Navy man himself. And he absolutely hated having to do it. And I believe that he hated having to do it. But anyway, that was a really remarkable thing. It was very important, as it happens, in terms of asserting to Hitler that Britain was serious, it was definitely going to stay in this war, but also asserting the same point to FDR that Britain was a serious player. They were not just going to cave and under the threat of German domination. And so it was a very symbolic and powerful act in that respect.
There's a question from a listener named John who is curious to know your perspective on Churchill's views on British Jews, particularly given the anti-Semitism of his son Randolph.
Yeah, very, very, very complicated views. And in the course of this particular year, he doesn't even get into it. There's no reference to Jews or otherwise, but he was a very complicated guy. He could sound like an anti-Semite in one turn, and the next thing you know, he sounds like he's exactly the opposite. So,
but his son was not only anti-Semitic, as we said, kind of a ne'er-do-well. He's been some strange comparisons to Hunter Biden. I don't know. Do you make anything out of that?
No, I have not heard those comparisons to Hunter Biden at all. And if anybody has tried to compare Randolph Churchill to Hunter Biden, I mean, they just obviously have no grasp of history or grasp of the story. I mean, Randolph Churchill was an absolute was a ne'er-do-well. He was a gambler. He was, I think, dependent on alcohol. He was a philanderer. He also actually had certain talents in terms of army public relations and so forth when he was stationed in the Middle East. But there simply is no comparison between Biden and Randolph. I don't even know what I have nothing even to say about Hunter Biden. The whole thing, apparently, in my view, is a concoction of a sort of right wingers who were trying to change the flow of politics.
Well, one thing about Randolph Churchill, though, in terms of his gambling, his ineptitude at gambling was almost legendary, wasn't it?
Yes. He not only was he a passionate gambler, he didn't know how to do it, so he ran up tremendous debts, and that ultimately is what caused the marriage to Pamela Churchill to blow up.
Can you also talk a bit about Sarah Churchill? Because I think it's pretty clear you were a bit charmed by her.
Not Sarah Churchill, Mary Churchill.
I mean, Mary Churchill, the younger daughter. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Mary. Yes. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Did it come through that clearly? Oh, anyway. So, yeah, Mary Churchill, I was very lucky to be granted access to her diary. She has this really comprehensive day-to-day diary, which is held by the Churchill Archive Center in Cambridge. But when I started the work on this book, that diary was not accessible to research, not yet accessible. And I asked, well, how is there any way I could get access? And the only way was to contact Mary's daughter, which I did. I waited, didn't hear anything for maybe 3 or 4 weeks, and I assumed, well, that was going to be a dead end. And then suddenly, she granted me permission, and to read and use this diary. And it was a revelation to me, because Mary, who was 17 at the start of the action in the book, and turns 18 1941. Mary was an absolute charmer. She was very, very bright, very articulate. Her diary is a mix of astute political observations, warm reflections on her father, but also, and this is very important to me, she was, after all, a 17-year-old girl who wanted to have fun. And she did have fun, and she wrote about the fun that she had. She'd talk about, going to dances at RAF bases, and she makes several references in the course of 1940-41 to snogging in the hayloft. So she was a real charmer. I think she makes the book, frankly.
I think we're also charmed by her as fathers of daughters. Let me bring another caller aboard here. Bruce joins us next. Bruce, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I read David Irving's book based on Goebbels' diaries, and in there was an interesting thing about Churchill. They were Hitler and his staff were confounded by what they perceived as Churchill's reluctance in the initial stages of the Battle of Britain to launch his air defenses against German air power, and it gave the impression that Churchill was sacrificing his people in order to build up support for his war, and in essence, he was, a warmonger.
Are you talking about the same David Irving that's a Holocaust denier, I guess, aren't you?
Well, regardless of his accusations about him, I don't actually think he's a Holocaust denier, but he does give a very, as a historian. He does give a very he goes for primary sources and tries to do a true.
Well, Bruce, we've got seconds left. Let me get right to the heart of that. Warmonger Churchill, your thoughts, Eric Larson, on that?
I read Goebbels' diaries, and I did not get that sense at all in terms of their perception of him and what he was trying to do. And I'm sufficiently cognizant, sufficiently aware of what the situation actually was on the ground and in the air in Britain during this period. I totally disagree with that Irving thesis.
We got seconds left. Quick question from a listener who wants to know your favorite TV or movie portrayal of Churchill.
I don't have one. I really don't. They're all honestly, and this is not to take anything from the actors or the directors or whatever. They're honestly so far off the mark of the real guy that it's I can't even answer the question. That's what I found as I was doing my research, and that's one reason I was so glad that I did not try to soak up all the video representations of him.
Well, because to get the real picture, they're going to have to read your work, and I trust that they will. Always good to have you with us, Eric. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. This is great fun. Thanks.
That's Eric Larson. His book is The Splendid and the Vile, and we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. Another hour of Forum up ahead. Please stay safe. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.
Support for Forum comes from San Francisco Opera. Set 10 years after a school shooting, the critically acclaimed opera Innocence takes us into a complex emotional journey where our understanding of innocence and guilt is constantly upended. Kaija Saariaho's ethereal score collapses the past into the present as a community of survivors grapple with how to move forward. Don't miss the highly anticipated American premiere of Innocence, June 1st through 21st. Learn more at sfopera.com.
We've all got those parts of our house where the internet just won't go. Well, if you had wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you could worry less about dead spots. Because with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you get fast speeds, reliable connection in every room, and power for all of your devices, even when everyone's online. That's wall-to-wall Wi-Fi, only with Xfinity. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.